Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the fiction writer Anthony Varallo. Anthony Varallo's new book of stories, Out Loud, was selected by Scott Turow as winner of the 2008 Drew Hines Literature Prize and was published by the University of Pittsburgh Press. Varallo is an assistant professor of English at the College of Charleston, South Carolina. His first short story collection, This Day in History, won the 2005 John Simmons Short Fiction Award. Varallo is the recipient of an NEA Fellowship, and his stories have appeared in Gettysburg Review, New England Review, Epic, and Harvard Review, among other publications. Hi, Anthony. How are you?
Good. Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
Yeah, we're glad to have you. And congratulations on all your success. A lot is happening for you.
Yeah, it's been more than I ever would have imagined, and I feel very, very lucky to win the Drew Hines Prize.
Yeah, it's a big one.
Thank you.
Okay, and you're going to begin with something from your new book, Out Loud.
Yeah, thanks. I'll read a short selection from the first story in the collection. The story is called In the Age of Automobiles, and a writer's never sure where a story really begins. But for me, a lot of my stories begin with the memory, and this story begins with the memory of the old parking lot outside my school, eighth grade, and I remember walking to the bus each day, and I remember having this terrible feeling that one day the buses would be gone, and I would be stranded at school, and there'd be no way for me to get home, and I think maybe that was the point of departure for this one. The story is called In the Age of Automobiles. Cody was surprised to see Mr. Turner getting into a Toyota Tercel. He would have imagined Mr. Turner driving something more like his mother's car, a Pontiac Bonneville, or maybe even a town car. But of course Mr. Turner couldn't afford a town car on a teacher's salary. Mr. Turner wore polyester blend dress shirts and had a habit of taking large swallows of coffee from a Colonial Williamsburg coffee mug, a souvenir from last year's disastrous field trip there. That was the day Cody had been sent home for fighting, but hadn't even thrown a punch. He'd cried in front of the entire seventh grade, a humiliation he couldn't afford to think about now if he wanted to get home before his mother. Her shift at the supermarket ended at 4:30. Mr. Turner had already started the engine when Cody put his hand to the passenger window and knocked. A loose beard of snow fell from the window. "Mr. Turner?" Mr. Turner rolled the window down. "Well, hello, Cody," he said. He was wearing the fake fur hat everyone made fun of behind his back. "Didn't see you there for a second, then voila, there you were." "Sorry," Cody said. "Everything okay?" "Uh-huh." "Did you miss your bus?" Cody hadn't missed his bus. He'd stayed late for band practice, then got off the activities bus when Jason Kiefer and Mike Rui threw his snow boots out the window. "Yeah," Cody said. The boots had landed right side up on a plow-packed snowbank. "I guess maybe I need a ride. I'm really sorry about asking. I really am." "Don't be," Mr. Turner said. "Hop on in." "I'm really sorry," Cody said. Again. When would he stop saying sorry so much? "It'll warm up in here in a minute," Mr. Turner said. Inside, the car smelled faintly fusty, like a library book. The defroster sent widening half-moons of clear glass across the front windshield. "You can put that in the back seat if you want," Mr. Turner said, indicating Cody's clarinet case. "That's okay," Cody said. "Is that an oboe?" "Clarinet." "Ah," Mr. Turner said. The clarinet goes doodle 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 det." "Yeah," Cody said. "Don't ask me how I remember that," Mr. Turner said. They pulled out of the parking lot, where Cody could see the snow already beginning to adhere to the highway. The sight of that always pleased him, since he felt in some way responsible for the snow, although he knew he really wasn't. It was amazing, all the dumb things he thought he might be responsible for. "Everyone keeps telling me I'll get used to this weather eventually," Mr. Turner said. He reached across the wheel to pull the turn signal again. A car even smaller than Mr. Turner's turned past them, an enormous Christmas tree stuffed into its hatchback. A yellow tag hung from the tree's sappy stump. Although Christmas was less than a week away, Cody's mother still hadn't gotten a tree. He would have to remind her of that. "Who's driving who, right?" Mr. Turner said. "Yeah." Cody tried to laugh, but nothing came out. The defroster had worked its way to the top of the window, Cody noticed. The noise of it offered comfort, the way his vaporizer did. That was a secret Cody was glad no one knew. He still slept with a vaporizer sometimes. "I don't miss the lightning, though," Mr. Turner said. "That's one thing I can say about this weather. At least there's no lightning." Mr. Turner was from Florida. No hurricanes, either. An odd place to be from. It was embarrassing the way Mr. Turner wore leather sandals in the springtime, the way he cheered for incorrect sports teams like the Miami Dolphins, the way he pronounced lawyer as lawyer instead of lawyer the way everyone else did. Cody nodded. He tried to think of something to say about Florida, but the truth was he'd only been there once when he was 5. His memory of the place was of a crowded beach where his bucket was dragged to sea, of the strange solitary cactus plant that grew in his grandparents' stony lawn, of the alligator farm where his grandfather had encouraged him to throw a fistful of feed from a fenced-in footbridge. The feed had dispersed in the air like chimney ashes and landed on the alligators' backs, who neglected to lick it away. This depressed Cody. "But I've got a good little car." Mr. Turner was telling Cody about driving the car from Florida to Delaware, all in one shot, 21 hours. "Wow," Cody said. "I tell you, by the end I was seeing phantom deer, if you know what I mean." Cody didn't know what he meant. "I know what you mean," he said. The snow picked up enough that Mr. Turner had to use his wipers. Cody was glad to have the wipers, since they helped cover the silence that had sprung up between them, again. It was horrible, trying to think of things to say. How did adults always manage to think of things to say? "I'm glad, actually, that we ran into each other today," Mr. Turner said. "I've been meaning to get back to you about your research paper." Cody felt his face grow warm. "Sorry," he said. "I'm real sorry about that." "No need," Mr. Turner said, then sneezed. Mr. Turner looked sort of sad when he sneezed. Cody wasn't sure whether to say bless you or not. "Have you given any thought to our agreement?" Cody nodded. "I'm real sorry about that," he said. "I'll get it to you after the break." The paper had been about the moon, a topic of Cody's own choosing, but he'd forgotten about it until the night before it was due. The only reference books around were the paperback dictionary his mother kept in her sewing table, and his father's old 1961 encyclopedia set, still smelling like aftershave, with its short but rapturous entry about the possibility of a manned moon landing. Cody had lifted most of his paper from the text. It was fun, figuring out how to reword things, using the dictionary for long, unnecessary definitions like crater, atmosphere, gravity, and galaxy. His mother typed the paper up on his father's old Royal typewriter while the two of them watched Dallas.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the writer Anthony Varallo. And he's reading from his new book, which is entitled Out Loud. It's the winner of the 2008 Drew Hines Prize and was chosen by the writer Scott Turow. So I wanted to ask you about the sadness in your work. Seems like there's an underlying sadness. And I like how it's always there, but it's not broadcasted. And the writer Scott Turow talked about your work as greater than the sum of its parts. And I was wondering, is it one of your intentions to create a poignancy, a compassionate voice in your work?
Well, sure. I think that a writer, you know, strives to be subtle, to be artful. Certainly that's something that I hold as an ambition in my own work. Readers, I think, read a story darker than the writer intended.
Really?
Yeah, I think so. I think a story read on the page reads darker than the one the writer had in mind, and somehow read aloud becomes lighter. I'm always surprised when I give a reading to hear people laughing. Sometimes the story seems to have lost about 10 pounds in weight just by virtue of it being read aloud. But I know that, as you said, there is a certain sadness in the stories. I'm always hoping for as much compassion for the characters as I can without sentimentalizing them. But yes, there is that kind of quietness, that kind of sadness. That's something I'm attentive to in my writing. I really don't write with an intent to to sort of make that happen on the page. I'm more listening to the characters. I usually know very little about them when I start the story. I have no idea what the ending is going to be. I have no idea where things are going to go. And I'm just trying to ask, what happens next? What would they really say? What would they really do?
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in this stories reading darker on the page thing. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that a little? Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I teach creative writing classes. I teach fiction workshops. And we read contemporary short stories. I assign various anthologies every year. And my students want to complain that the stories are depressing, which is a common charge against the contemporary short story. It's depressing. But when I have the stories read the story aloud, so take, for example, we'll read a Dennis Johnson story, who's a writer they find depressing. He writes about characters in extremes whose luck have run out and in very tough situations. When the story is read aloud, suddenly the class, I see a change in their expressions, and they realize all the humor that was really in the story. And it's not the kind of humor you would see on a TV sitcom. It's a different kind of humor. But it really reveals itself when that story is read aloud, especially when the dialogue is as like Dennis Johnson writes amazing dialogue. You start to hear it, and they start to hear a different story than the one they read the night before. That story that struck them is so dark and, as they like to put it, depressing.
Mm-hmm. But do you think it's the life of the voice or the the communal experience of listening or?
Mm-hmm. It's probably a little bit of both. I think writing deserves or asks to be read aloud. That's when you really understand what it's wanting to do, what are its properties. Mm-hmm. So something seems to happen just the in reading the work aloud that makes it offer up the humor that wasn't so evident on the quiet reading.
Mm-hmm. It can be a little disconcerting sometimes, though, if you're giving a reading and people are laughing at moments mm-hmm. when you think you have no humor whatsoever.
It is. I've also had that experience, and I certainly know that feeling. You know, and maybe it's just one of those things that's another mystery of writing. And I feel like almost everything about writing is a mystery, and writers know very little what they're doing. We might wish to know, or we might set out to know, but the list of what we don't know greatly exceeds the list of what we do know.
Okay. Can you read something more?
Sure. Thank you. I'll read from the next story in the collection. The story is called The Walkers, and I wrote this story when I was a graduate student at the University of Missouri. I lived in Columbia, Missouri, a college town of about 90,000. And my wife and I lived in a fairly nice neighborhood during my years there. But we were renting. I was living on a graduate stipend. We didn't have much money. But the neighborhood we lived in was much nicer than, probably nicer than we deserved to be living in. And I remember taking long walks with my wife. We had this very ritualized walk we would take every evening. And I remember this desire to feel included in this nice neighborhood. Sort of, I'd like to be accepted as one of these as one of these people. And I remember talking with my wife and trying to imagine what the lives were behind the houses, behind the various walkers we would see walking and sometimes wave to. And that perhaps gave rise to this story. It's called The Walkers. The couple with the baby stroller walks the neighborhood at 4. They make an athletic-looking pair, she in gray sweatpants, a yellow Walkman strapped to her arm, he with a striped headband and a V of sweat showing through his T-shirt, although it is not especially hot outside. Has he just come from a tennis match or the treadmill? They are the kind of people that would own a treadmill. The treadmill looking out onto a lawn that slopes toward the man-made pond, we have only ever seen the station wagon couple attempt to fish, both clearly in retirement, the husband toting an ancient creel and walking the water's edge in hip waders meant, we assume, for river fishing. The wife does not fish. She stays in the station wagon, smoking, reading TV Guide. That is what we love about this wife, her indifference to her husband's curses, his lines snagged in the poplars that have always struck us as looking a little out of place, like dinner candles stuck into a cupcake. Whose idea were these? Anyway, we'd love for them to say hello sometime, but we understand if they prefer to keep to themselves. That's something we understand completely. We're not trying to change that. Already we've forgotten about the baby stroller couple. Our forgetting reminds us that although we are interested in these couples, these walkers, that we in some way feel ourselves to be connected to them, we do not actually know them. Their daily passing both draws us closer and pushes us back, like a poorly planned series of chess moves. We want to know them, but how? How much we would like to say, "Oh, I saw the Mosers today, pushing little Gregory in his stroller. You wouldn't believe his grip. Patty says he's almost sleeping through the night now, but Brad made a face like, oh, don't you believe it, when Patty was fixing Gregory's hat. They said we should stop by sometime." What would they say if we stopped to ask about the baby? Surely people stop and ask about the baby. We could be people like that. Well, they seem nice, the stroller couple would think, watching us walk away. I wonder which house is theirs. We would like to know these walkers, so we walk. Look, we're walkers too, our walks say. Although when we come across other walkers, we become suddenly shy. We give the walkers one look, a quick glance, trying to determine if they're in a saying hello sort of mood. Not everyone is, of course. This is not a problem. It is completely fine for them to walk their own walk, thinking their own walking thoughts, all those hopes and worries, and even nothing at all thoughts like should we have asparagus or salad, visiting them as often as they visit us. These two walkers they see glancing up, then immediately away, as if we've spotted a rare bird. It is absolutely okay to ignore us, because we, if the walkers should ever stop to ask, and we're not saying this is a prerequisite to gaining our good graces, are absolutely respectful of privacy and quiet. We really are. We spend entire Sundays silently reading the Times, sipping coffee and sock-footing it around the living room, like visitors to a shrine. Even the radio is asked to hold it in for another day. If the walkers would ever care to stop, they might find that we, lovers of music and sunflowers and quiet neighborhoods like this, this wonderful wooded loop, we too love quiet and privacy. That is the purpose of a neighborhood like ours, isn't it? Privacy, solitude, to look out one's window and feel no one looking in, to lock one's door at night with a certain satisfaction, like closing the heavy-lidded eye of some fantastic dragon. But we're being absurd. We are nothing like a dragon. We subscribe to Newsweek. We know that you do, too. But what's with teen people? Just curious. The man with the three-legged dog walks around 5:30, 7 in the summertime. We've wondered about him. We've had conversations about him, usually during our own walk, whose time we change solely for the purpose of bumping into as many other walkers as possible. What's with the man with the three-legged dog, we've said. We've gotten several hellos from the three-legged dog man, even an enthusiastic lick from the three-legged dog, whose walk, now that we're on the subject, is surprisingly agile, elegant almost, like a dancer who's lost a shoe, but not the downbeat. He, we've been too shy to ask its name, has a remarkably long tongue, a sweet disposition, too. His owner follows him with an empty bread bag in one hand, a rolled-up newspaper in the other. This fastidiousness leads us to think that these are city people, this man and dog, more accustomed to heavily trafficked parks, with only a few slim rectangles of grass for relief. The man has sometimes worn a leather coat and rimless glasses, furthering our suspicions. Not that we're suspicious. We love the city. We love the whiff of fine dining, missed buses, and bowed cellos these walkers bring. We have a story about the three-legged dog man. It goes something like this. The three-legged dog man moved from the city with his three-legged dog and a beautiful woman. Why shouldn't she be beautiful? They lived in an apartment overlooking a park where they walked together, the dog on a short leash, leaves crunching underfoot, the dog drawing attention, children's hands, sympathy, questions, consolations. The dog circling the pretzel vendor, chasing stray napkins, testing the waters of the duck pond where breadcrumbs float. Their walks somehow amplifying the city around them, saying yes to skyscrapers, streetlights, benches, the homeless. How could the move to this small suburban neighborhood with only a trace of hustle, and let's just forget bustle, not disappoint the woman? This little neighborhood of gardeners and walkers closing in on her like a pulled belt. Not another kiddie pool. Enough already with the garden trolls. Why no public transportation to the farmer's market? She left him. He pleaded for her to stay. He gave reasons. She gave hers. They drove to the little bus station on the edge of town, the one that has always seemed so sad to us, with all those travelers just passing through, toting duffel bags the size of trash cans, who will never know the pleasure of a walk like ours, and parted. The dog licked her hand. The bus was late and gave off the smell of old fruit. The man helped her with her bags. She took a seat in front. They kissed. When the bus pulled away, we like to imagine the dog howling. Why not? This, the image the man cannot shake, even when we rub our hands through the dog's fur, the bus pulling out of the station, the dog straining against his leash. Is it any wonder he's forgotten to ask our names? That's the thing we would say if he ever chose to apologize for not introducing himself sooner. Don't worry about it, we'd say. Please.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the writer Anthony Varallo, and he's reading from his new book entitled Out Loud, winner of the 2008 Drew Hines Award, published by the University of Pittsburgh Press. There's such great vulnerability in your characters, and it almost seems like these are love stories to humans, you know.
Well, that's very nice. I like that a lot.
Do you?
I hope so. I mean, I hope in a way literature is a love story to humans. I mean, I hope it's I think the pleasure of reading is that feeling of enlisting your sympathy, enlarging your sympathy to the world. And that's not in a sentimental Disney sort of way. But that's something that's what's drawn me so much to writing, to literature, to the teaching of literature. The way it draws you closer to the world of feeling, if that's not too ridiculous to say.
Why would it be ridiculous?
Well, if you walked around saying, I'd like to draw you closer to the world of feeling, people might hit you over the head with the length of pipe and make fun of you, at least behind your back, that sort of thing. I mean, I think there's a certain caution about expressing those kind of feelings in literature and stories, novels and poems and essays. Break through that, and they allow a writer to risk being embarrassing. Or right, there's a sort of embarrassment in what a writer reveals to the reader. But the aim of that is to draw the reader's sympathy, to draw their empathy, and to suggest a certain connection between people and places, and certainly the past and present. That's important.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know, I agree with you, but it's disturbing in that, you know, why is it so unwelcome mm-hmm. to talk about writing in that way? I mean, especially since we're both teachers of writing.
Yeah.
Something off there.
There is. And your only hope is, as a teacher, that conversation becomes less and less embarrassing and less awkward. And I think the lessening of it comes through massive reading. And that's why it's so hard with students. They haven't read as much yet, and it's the reading that's going to instruct them about what's important and why literature matters.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. It's I like the phrase massive reading.
Massive
I think
reading.
I can use that.
That's how writers read. They read massively.
I know, as they should. Yeah. I wanted to ask you one more thing. You talked about your stories beginning with memory. Mm-hmm. Often, that there's a point of departure.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk just a little bit about the beginnings of your stories?
Yeah, sure.
How you go from that memory to the story?
Sure. Well, it's a tough transition from thinking of a memory where you know the details, you remember so well the feeling of going into your grandmother's basement and the way it smelled and I want to return the reader to that place. I want to get that on the page, you think, as a writer. But a story insists on narrative, on a sense of events building. So I think the danger is to have a character philosophically stroking his or her chin, looking out the window on a rainy day, recalling things. So when I'm thinking about the opening of my story, I'm thinking, how close can I start this to the end of the story, which sounds like a paradox since I don't know what the end is, but how close can I start toward the end? Where's the most interesting way into the story? when do we really need to meet these characters? And that takes some time just to figure out where that is. It takes some drafting and some misfires and miscues. But I'm looking for that one moment when something feels urgent, like the kid needing a ride home from his teacher. That's the moment when we want to meet him, even though it started with the memory of just a parking lot and my old school.
Okay. We have time for a short piece.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks. I'll read the opening of another story. This one's called Parade Rest, and it in some way recalls my experience being in high school marching band, which I was very shy to write about for years and years. It's hard to be proud of that experience somehow, but I finally found a way to get inside it in this story. Parade Rest. We're outside, spit-shining marching band cymbals, when Randy the Raven shows up. We both know it's Pete Hampson inside, but that doesn't make much difference, really. Pete's wearing his mascot head with its creepy wide eyes, his breath like a runner crossing the finish line. We used to be friends, Pete and I, back in middle school, but we never mention this anymore. I am 15, a cymbal player in the school marching band. My best friend is Larry Greer. It was Larry's idea to shine the cymbals outside to get the best possible light. Tonight, our football team is playing its homecoming game. You boys rubbing it up? Pete says. For the game, Larry says. The game, Pete says. You two like to play games? He puts his sneaker against the 20-inch crash I've been buffing to a shine. I've always hated the way you can see Randy the Raven's sneakers poking through the bottom of his costume, like a kid hiding behind a curtain. Ruins the effect. The football game, Larry says. Larry still collects action figures, although I am keeping this a secret under penalty of blackmail, since Larry knows I cried a little at the end of E.T. Rubbing it up for the big game, huh? Behind Pete, I see Christy Ulrich and Ashley Orr walk by, carrying silk flags. Ashley gives Pete a punch on the shoulder. Be nice, she warns. Randy the Raven loves all, Pete says. We're supposed to make them shine like mirrors, Larry explains. These are the words of our band director, Mr. Phillips. But Pete isn't listening. He's watching Jennifer and Ashley. I'm nice, he says. A moment later, he removes his mascot head, beneath which his bushy hair has conformed to the shape of Randy's cranium, a half moon or inverted bowl. We know we're cool, right, fellas? Pete extends a hand to me, like it's all good and whatnot. I guess, I say. I'm okay, you're okay. I guess. Because Timex takes a licking but keeps on ticking, Pete says. And that's a fact, Jack. Here is my problem. I have no idea what to do anymore. Should I grab Pete by the leg and swing him to the ground? Or should I say, and that's a fact, Jack, the way we used to when we were in middle school? Or should I act totally bored, not say anything at all, suggesting I'm holding tremendous wisdom in reserve? I've always wanted to be that kind of person. But when I end up doing is saying, that's way back, Jack. A laugh escapes my lips like a squeezed toy. Whatever, Pete says. A moment later, he's gone and I'm left with Larry, who should be mad at me, who should be seriously thinking about breaking off and finding some first-class, grade-A friendship, but of course isn't. Because he's Larry, and because really, who else is going to be friends with him? Pete's a good mascot, he says. I don't say anything. Lots of energy. I'll become a stone, I think, sinking to the bottom of a deep pond, heavy with dignity. Plus, he's tall, Larry says. He holds a symbol to the sun, inspecting it. Everybody likes a tall mascot.
The stories of Anthony Varallo. Thanks so much. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Ben Cole. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, independent public radio, 91.3 WYEP.